Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. I have missed you all this weekend. Boy, what a week. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Matt Murphy. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. And welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with WTN's Matt Murphy, heard daily from 12 to 3 on Supertalk 99.7. Matt Murphy was born in a small East Georgia town in the fall of 1973. Married to Erica, the world has known no peace nor quiet since, he says. Since landing a high school job at his beloved hometown AM radio station, Matt has enjoyed entertaining listeners all over the Southeast. After brief music stints in Augusta and Athens in Georgia, and getting fired for talking too much at the country music station, Murphy took the hint and moved over to talk radio in Montgomery, Alabama as a producer of the morning show. Within 3 months, he was the afternoon drive host. In summer of 2002, Matt began a 19-year stint in Birmingham that includes, in 2016, launching a powerhouse live and local FM news talker and assuming morning drive duties. The Murphy Show is fast-paced and highly opinionated, and special blend of political wisdom and entertaining water cooler conversations. Matt appeals to people from all walks of life with intellect and wit. Murphy specializes in turning sacred cows into mincemeat. Matt calls out the powerful by name, challenges their positions, and exposes corruption where it hides. Murphy speaks truth to power and puts the interests of the people first. Matt has been on air to cover every major breaking news event since 2000, from the terrorist tragedy of 9/11 to the terrible Alabama tornadoes of 2011. Murphy keeps the listening family informed on a daily basis. Matt is honored to join the incredible team at Supertalk 99.7 W2N and cannot wait to sink his teeth into Nashville and gobble up Middle Tennessee in large portions. But he has been doing that for a while. How are you today, sir?
Doing well, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Did I cover that okay?
I think so. It's a little daunting having your bio read to hear it in an audio fashion. I need to update all of that.
Yes.
Yes, thank you for the invitation, sure. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Well, as they say, your reputation precedes you because I just did it. Tell us about your coming up in Alabama and your time in radio there.
I had a wonderful opportunity. I had a couple of stints in radio in Georgia, as you mentioned, and I talked too much. I got fired for doing so in Augusta, Georgia, and I was out of radio for a little while and had a chance to hook up with a radio station in Montgomery through a mutual friend who was programming a news talk station. And I'd not really considered news talk to be an option. I was in my mid-20s, so it wasn't on my radar screen. But once I sunk my teeth into news talk and the events that surround what we do on news talk radio, it just everything kind of fell into place for me. So I immediately wanted to be a host when I became a producer, and I got the opportunity to do that in the afternoon drive in Montgomery, and was there for about 3 years, and got to Birmingham soon after. Got an opportunity to move to what we consider the big city, Birmingham, Alabama, and had some great opportunities there for about 16 years and enjoyed that very much. And Nashville called, through some sad circumstances. Obviously, most who are aware of News Talk Radio Nashville know of Phil Valentine, know of his passing. And when we lost Phil due to COVID a couple of years ago, I made some inquiries and sat down and talked to some folks and just felt like a really good fit. And it's been a wonderful time so far in the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm. So getting fired for talking too much and then getting to a super talk show means that it was meant to be. So that's fantastic. We're actually going to be having a special tribute show to Phil Valentine coming up here in the next few weeks. So Steve Gill is going to be with me on that to talk about their time together. So interesting that you took his place. A little bit segue before more about you in a minute, but big news in the cable news industry, and we are in talk and news. Dan Bongino, Tucker Carlson, both formerly at Fox now, and Don Lemon at CNN, all out within a day of AOC going on MSNBC, the host inside Jen Psaki, former Biden press secretary, and calling for Tucker to be fired. What do you make of this shakeup just as Biden's, 2024 campaign kicks off? I think yesterday was the announcement. Is Psaki the news designated king of cable news now?
You know, I don't know that I would say that Jen has ascended to that level quite yet. I don't know, and I think it remains to be seen, Steve, how much the Bongino situation and the Tucker deal have to do with one another. When Bongino's contract was not renewed with Fox, he said that it was amicable, that, they just couldn't reach a deal that was good for both parties, and that he had nothing but love for the folks over at Fox. Okay, that's all well and good, but then you couple that with the unceremonious firing of Tucker Carlson just several days later, and one wonders if this is not a part of a broader shakeup. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But Rupert Murdoch has a tendency, has a history. If you look back over his life cycle in media, he has a tendency of firing big names and is most certainly willing to do that, even at the sacrifice or the potential sacrifice for his network. Very different circumstances surrounding Bill O'Reilly's departure. Obviously, right. There were a lot of allegations about sexual impropriety there, but he was not afraid. I mean, Bill O'Reilly was the face of Fox News when he was dismissed from his position.
Maybe more echoes of Glenn Beck, the way I see it. If Bartiromo goes and, say, Jeanine Pirro, then we know that it has something to do with Dominion Resources.
Right. So, and I thought, on the Dominion front, I was asked the question, do you think this has to do with Tucker's role in all of that and the amount of money that Fox eventually had to pay to Dominion? And it's hard for me to believe that Tucker would go before individuals that seem to have much Judge Jeanine and others who had more of an active role in pushing the narrative that turned out to be completely false. Tucker was there, but he was certainly not front and center as much as some of those other names.
The Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because within 24 hours of her saying he should be fired on that show, he was, and it surprised everybody, and he signed off on Friday saying, see y'all next week. He didn't seem to know it was coming.
Well, I mean, I think if AOC had that level of power, Steve, I think she would just shut off the lights at Fox News and call it a day. I mean, I don't know that many people within the Fox News circle, give a lot of weight to what AOC has to say about things. I mean, obviously, she has her belief set. A lot of conservatives feel the same way about some of the presentation of some of the more left of center media organizations like MSNBC. I think there's room for everyone. I think there's room for different perspectives. I think what the argument would be, and obviously where Fox crossed the line on Dominion, is that this is not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of misinformed individuals saying things that are factually untrue and allowing that to happen over and over again repeatedly on a network. So, I don't believe that AOC had anything to do with Tucker leaving.
Fox
have
News
heard
Corp
that it was a snap decision, though.
It did seem like it. And Fox News Corp has lost about $1 billion in market cap value. They say go woke, go broke. It's proved time and time again. So we'll have to see if they were doing it because it was a stand that they were saying they didn't want to have conservative voices be that conservative. I don't know. Talking to you about that is important because I think that's where you fall. So you were asked nicely to leave Birmingham Radio. We talked about that. You did bounce back. How'd you handle that firing? And do you think Tucker will do something independent or end up at CNN? Or what do you think how do you think he'll handle it like you'd handled it?
Okay. So yeah, I actually wasn't asked to leave in Birmingham. I did get let go from a radio station in Birmingham about 5 years into Birmingham because they changed formats. Oh. And then I immediately hooked up with another station in town. On the music side of it, I was let go from the music side of it simply for talking too much. And there's a lot of format changes going on there. But well, I think, talented people rise to the top. I think talented people will find a way to get their opinions out there. I don't think Tucker's done in the same way. Bill O'Reilly's resurfaced in a few ways, but Bill O'Reilly had a lot more age on him. He had a lot more experience. It was kind of, he was in the winter season of his service as a host. I don't think Tucker's there yet. So especially considering that it was a Fox, initially, they said it was a parting of the ways. So you don't know who initiated it or what the deal was. Well, now we know that Fox terminated Tucker's contract. I think they're going to pay the remainder of the money on his contract just to get him off the air. So one would expect that Tucker, probably that's going to light a fire under him. I don't know if that's going to change the manner of his presentation in any way, but I would not be surprised at all if he doesn't pop up rather soon on another network or engage in a way that, like Glenn Beck, you mentioned Beck. I don't think Beck's ever gotten to the popularity that he was at in the mid-2000s when he was on Fox. I mean,
reminds me of someone who did really well is Megyn Kelly. She was let go unceremoniously from Fox, ended up at NBC, I believe, and then has now been huge, making mega millions as a podcaster. Like, I'm not doing that, but you on radio. So we have airwave competition for sure.
Well, and you bring that up too, Steve. The dynamic is so different in 2023 than it was even in 2005 or 2010, in as much as people are consuming information in such different ways. We're not certainly beholden to networks, and we're not even beholden to cable news any longer as to how people get news and receive information. They listen to podcasts or they watch podcasts like you. They watch me on a podcast or on a YouTube stream as opposed to having to wait for the radio show to come on. So I think younger consumers are picking and choosing more a la carte the information that they consume, which I think is in a way a good thing. It's very, very democratic in that way. But also I think it serves to polarize us from a political or ideological standpoint, because we consume a lot of what reaffirms our belief structure and system, and there's less and less exposure to the types of things that we don't believe very much. I don't watch a lot of MSNBC. I try to because I want to know what they have to say about things. I watch a lot of CNN, however, and I do it not because I necessarily fall along the ideological lines of a Don Lemon or an Anderson Cooper, but because I want to know what their arguments are. Even if I disagree with them, iron sharpens iron, as the saying goes. So
for those that aren't familiar with you, are you conservative minded?
I consider myself, I'm a libertarian with a small L, meaning that I believe in a basic philosophy that you own you, the government nor no other man owns you, and you should be the determining factor of your own fate so long as you don't deprive other people of their liberties and their rights as well. So that puts me very, very physically conservative, probably more physically conservative than any so-called Republican. But at the same time, I'm very socially liberal. I've for 20 years, I've argued for, the rights of gay people to get married, for example, or I've argued that while I might disagree with an individual's lifestyle, so long as they're not harming any other people or depriving other people of their rights, who am I to say how they are to live their lives? So I say I'm a libertarian with a small L because I don't belong to the Libertarian Party, and I disagree with some of the Libertarian Party's basic platforms, but I consider myself a libertarian.
Hmm. And how did the opportunity to move to Nashville come about? You said Phil Valentine left a vacuum and stuff, but how did you...
Phil passed away, and obviously you have to fill that time. And Super Talk 99.7 WTN is live and local, meaning that they, I feel like the best voices on our platform, wherever they might be, are the local voices. And Super Talk believes in that as well. So they're local from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. at night, which is in this day and age somewhat of a rarity because it's a little cost prohibitive. At the same time, they had a vacancy, and I contacted the program director, and we got to talk, and I think he was fielding a lot of interviews, and it seemed like a good fit. And I did a few fill-in shows in the midday slot, and they brought me up to do the noon to three slot. They did some shuffling around in Phil's absence, and that's how I got here.
Okay. Is 99.7 a great place to work?
It is in our industry. Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it is a wonderful place to work. We've got a lot of good people here. I mean, outside of what we do on air, there's just a lot of good souls in the building, I like to say. Secondarily, nice. I mean, Super Talk is known in the industry as just being a behemoth in terms of what we do. It's an incredibly well listened to station. It is a bedrock in Middle Tennessee. And I find myself lucky every day that I walk in the building. That I'm surrounded by the legacy that has been Super Talk and built by voices like Steve Gill and Phil Valentine and Ralph Bristol and so many other voices that came before me.
And you fill in a lot for Brian Wilson. What's Brian Wilson like?
Brian's a great guy. I mean, Brian loves to correct you when you're wrong. And Brian has a wealth of knowledge. And I say that in love. I mean, he doesn't do it in terms of shaming you or whatever, but I mean, he's got an incredible amount of knowledge in that brain of his. You know, he spent so much time in Washington, D.C. He has so much industry knowledge of how things work inside of the Beltway. It's fascinating to listen to his stories about flying with Bill Clinton in the 1990s when he was a White House correspondent for Fox News, for the young fledgling Fox News. So he's got a great amount of stories there. And it's an honor just to slide into that role. You know, Dan offered me the opportunity to slide into afternoons when Brian's away. And so I take him up every chance I get.
What about Pam Furr and Dan Mandis? They're coming on here pretty soon. What are your opinions?
Pamela is just any. I don't know of anyone in Nashville that knows more people than Pamela Furr from so many different walks of life. Right? You know, you've got the. When I came to Nashville, I learned that, you know, there were lanes. There was the country music lane, and there was, you know, that more of a conservative vein, and, you know, and from a political ideological spectrum, you had the more liberal lane. And Pamela knows someone from all of the, you know, she knows everybody. She's been here since 1991, so she's just a wealth of knowledge and information there. And Dan is, you know, I have not had a better boss than Mandis. I mean, I say good things. He is my boss, so, you know, Steve, I kind of have to be nice about him, but. I wouldn't lie to you. He's a great guy. And Dan is, if Dan's coming on, Dan's an incredible story of persistence and a guy that knew what he wanted to do in the industry and accomplished it. I mean, going from, I mean, for those who remember Dr. Laura Schlesinger,
yeah,
she's a nationally syndicated, I don't know if she was a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but she was a counselor on air. Dan was her producer. Uh-huh. Like Dan produced her nationally syndicated show. And I asked Dan, I said, how did you go from that to this? And he said, look, I wanted to be a host. I loved what I was doing, making great money, enjoyed what I was doing, but I wanted to host a show. And he made that happen. So he's a fascinating guy to work with. He's been a great boss.
Awesome. All right. And so what's your favorite part about radio versus, say, podcasting or TV or movies or any other authors or books?
You have a different world every day. I mean, it changes every day. I mean, you know, just like as you have guest to guest to guest every day, I mean, what we do any given day at any given moment during the show, everything can change like that, you know, for good or for bad. You know, oftentimes we're talking about negative events that happen in the news, but sometimes we're talking about positive events as well. But every day it's something new, it's something different. You never know what you're going to get. I love interacting with people. I'm of all the shows on Super Talk, I'm probably the most caller driven. I think that's fair to say, simply because I love interacting for better or worse with the community in which I serve. I look at what we do as a reflection of the community that we serve and kind of ballast as well. And it depends on the subject matter as to what we're going to be. You know, it's interesting. I think sometimes what we do gets overcomplicated a little bit. It's really just a matter of being true to yourself, but understanding you need to present that truth in such a way that people want to listen to you. I mean, it's just as simple as that. I mean, people tell me all the time, Steve, that they say, boy, it must be hard to talk for 3 hours a day on the radio. And I say, you know, it's actually easier than you think. It's easy to talk for 3 hours on the radio. Anybody can do it. The trick is talking for 3 hours on the radio in a way that people actually want to listen to you. That's the harder thing. So the people that we get to interact with on a day-to-day basis. And then I think the third leg of that stool is probably, you know, making sure that you act as a voice for those that don't consider themselves powerful when you are speaking to those that do consider themselves powerful, mainly politicians, or, you know, others in the community, you know, business leaders or whatnot, that have very strong voices, often accompanied by very large wallets. And on occasion, maybe they're not talking to the little guy. Maybe they're not speaking for the little guy. I need to act as their proxy when I have the opportunity.
Mm. You know, they want to take AM radios out of cars, the Teslas and the whatnots. Do you think that's going to hurt, especially conservative talk radio? Any thoughts on that?
You know, I know that there's a lot of consternation in our industry, and I know that a lot, you know, our company and there are many other companies that own a lot of these properties that have a lot of value, and that value gets diminished if you don't have the ability to find them on AM radio. At the same time, I've watched the last 10 years, the industry has shifted. I mean, Super Talk was on the forefront of that. There was a time, and I was involved very much in Birmingham in flipping a station from AM to FM, a news talk station, right? And there was a time when industry insiders considered it a waste of the FM signal to use it on the spoken word because of the difference between mono and stereo. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, word really doesn't need stereo, but the music does. So it was considered a waste to put a sports format or a news talk format on an FM stick when you could put country or whatever. And times have significantly changed, and I've seen a lot of news talkers gravitate to the FM stick. So I think it's less impactful than it would have been 10 or 15 years ago. At the same time, I think that there's still some very much considered value in AM, and there's going to be a pushback on the idea of removing it from automobiles.
Especially for the long-haul truckers, let's say. They don't all want Sirius satellite radios, right? You need to have that AM. So what's your interview process? I know you do call-ins and you do interviews. I heard you today talking to Governor Bill Lee, as a matter of fact. Do you do your own research right before or more improv?
You know, I try – well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, obviously, I have a set list of questions or topics that I want to discuss. And more often than not, if it's a newsmaker – that's kind of baked into the cake. I mean, it's pretty baked in that when I have Governor Lee on today, we're going to talk about the session that just ended and the special session that he's called for. And normally with those types of interviews, you have very set amount of time. They structure it that way. I mean, and I'm not talking about Governor Bill Lee when I say this, but it's been my experience, Steve, that political figures know that when they're dealing with somebody like me, the currency that they have to hold against me is access, right? So if it's a senator or a governor or a candidate for something, they know that I'm going to want to engage them on a regular basis over the life of their term as governor, for example. So if we just go hammer and tongs against one another and I do something that's off the rails, I understand that that's pretty much limited or eliminated my access to any future conversation. They know that. Right. So they typically understand that these conversations aren't going to go off the rails in any significant way. At the same time, I balance that against what I know the listening audience wants to find out. I mean, I have a sense of where they want me to go in these conversations, what they want to find out from their elected officials. And I can't be afraid to broach those subjects that might be sensitive to those politicians for fear that they're going to deny me access. I learned a long time ago, if you try to walk that line, you're going to fail the audience and you're probably going to lose access anyway. So you may as well go there as honestly and earnestly as you can. What I try to accomplish in any given interview is after the interview's over, even if the person that I have interviewed is a little bit annoyed at me, they can't deny that it was a fair-minded set of questions that I came after them at. So it's a long way to answer your question. I formulate some topics, sometimes some specific questions, but then I make sure to try to listen as best I can, which is harder than you think. Yeah. To really listen to the answer that you're getting, to know when you might want to dig a little bit deeper, you want to explore a little bit further. The limiting factor that I have that you don't, and I'm so jealous of those that have mastered the podcast in a way that I never have, is the time frame.
No commercials.
I always lust for more time, right? Because we're limited with commercials and we're limited, you know, in 10-minute blocks of time. Even if you have them, you know, for a 30-minute or an hour-long period of time, you still have to go to these commercial breaks. And so oftentimes I lament that I don't get to explore some of the topics that I'd like to, but that's kind of the way I do it.
Okay. Did you have a talk radio role model before you got into it? Maybe as a kid, did you listen on the AM radio to maybe early Rush or
anyone? I listened to when I went to college. I grew up in Augusta, or just outside of Augusta, Georgia. I went to school in Carrollton at West Georgia College, which is basically a suburb of Atlanta, about 30 miles outside of Atlanta. And Neil Bortz was on in Atlanta, Georgia at the time. He had just moved from WGST to WSB. And I caught Neil a couple of times and I got hooked. I'd never heard anything like it. And it's really where I would say I got my libertarian roots, because Neil was always a self-described libertarian, which made him a contrarian. And I've kind of developed this reputation as well, that I'm a contrarian no matter, you know, who's coming at me, Democrats or Republicans or whatever. There's always something that I can complain or moan about. So regarding the politicians. So that's where I kind of built the structural foundation of my philosophy of government, my ideological underpinnings. My mentor in the business was in Montgomery. He's a guy by the name of Don Markwell, who hired me for my first full-time gig in talk. Don was just, he's a name that nobody listening to this will recognize necessarily, but he was an absolute institution in Montgomery, Alabama. And he, you know, he's a 70-year-old man that gave a 25-year-old punk a chance to talk for a couple of hours in the afternoons on the radio. And, you know, I like to tell people I'll never forgive him for that.
All right. So 5 years ago, back to 2018, a deranged white man killed 4 people at a Waffle House here in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Phil Williams at Channel 5 is still blaming Sexton for that and the legislature for not passing any gun laws this session. Now, there's a special session. We don't know what it's going to do, but they're saying no. They're saying yes. We don't know. I think Phil Williams, that even if they did, that's a cure-all for the violence in the world. I don't know. Do you know Phil? Ever had him on? What do you think he's thinking?
I've invited Phil Williams on the show. I don't think he lowers himself to do little radio shows like ours. I think he prefers to stick to television. I'd love to have him on, just to get where his mindset is as he decides on how to do some of the interviews and which to do and which not to do. I mean, there's a very interesting thing that goes on in terms of the curiosity of the media, that I find that the media tends to, and I think Phil, I would put him in this category. I think he's very good at what he does when he does it. I'm just fascinated what he is intellectually curious about and what he's not. You know, he didn't seem that intellectually curious about the background of the Bullhorn Trio, or the Tennessee Three, as they're called, right? And how they didn't bother to introduce legislation regarding guns or gun control prior to the Covenant School event. But he's incredibly intellectually curious about other things. And these tend to fit into certain ideological categories. I don't begrudge him that. I think it's human nature that if you are of a certain mindset, you're going to gravitate to certain stories. And if you're of a different mindset, you probably gravitate to different stories. All that to say, I don't know Phil. I think when he does a story, I think he buttons it down. And I have respect for that. I have respect for him not shooting from the hip and making sure that he has everything lined up. And in the nature of what he does as an investigative reporter, he better have that buttoned down. But I don't think there's any question that Phil has a tendency of targeting conservatives more vociferously than he does liberals.
Yeah. I'm a big movie buff, and I liken him to the reporter in Die Hard. You know, he's willing to read what's put in front of him, but he's not really going to change his style much for the news of the day. Do you know who Lizzo is?
I don't. The musician?
I didn't.
Singer, I guess. Lizzo?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if she can actually sing, but she does go on stage and tramps around a lot with the microphone in her mouth. Yeah. You know, let's just say plus size singer. I think she sings. I don't know. But anyway, she was in Nashville this weekend and said, you know, she had a concert at Bridgestone. She said, what people are doing in Tennessee is giving hope. Thank you for standing up for your rights. So aside from the memories of hope and change from the first Obama campaign, which resulted in no change, she says she was told to cancel her show to where people needed to hear the message the most instead by coming here and saying it, that Tennessee is totally under the microscope for gun laws. I'm framing this wrong, but we all know we're under the microscope for gun laws. She brought onto the stage drag queens, and this was an all-ages show at Bridgestone. And you know, and I know, that laws were just passed that says you can't do that. And so what I'm trying to say is we're under the microscope. She did this. She broke our law, let's just say. She's a big famous musician. Should she be put in jail or fined for her drag
You know,
show
I mean,
in front of
Steve, I
kids.
would have to see what she did. I mean, because I think what happened in the state of Tennessee the last legislative session has been completely mischaracterized by the national news media and the narrative that they present, right? They presented this as a drag show ban, which you and I live here. We know that that's not what it was. We are a permissive state. We believe in freedom. We believe in one's ability to act in a manner of one's choosing, even if that might go against my moral compass or my personal and spiritual beliefs. So that said, the drag ban was all about keeping it from in front of our children and putting us in positions where we find ourselves in the middle of a drag show in a coffee shop or whatever. So I'd have to look at what she did. If she violated the law, she should be treated like everyone else. If she engaged in a sexually explicit burlesque performance where she knew children were present, well, that's a violation of the law, and she should be prosecuted. I don't know if she should be arrested. I don't know what the punishment factor is, but, you know, but yeah, I mean, she should be treated like anyone else.
She flagrantly violated it on purpose. I mean, we've seen Jim Morrison, Green Day, Charlie Parker, even Elvis paid big fines and even jail for indecency law breaking. So I would think, and if Tennessee is going to stick to their guns, they should make an example out of her.
I would also push back on this front too. And this is kind of where my libertarian roots come out. Mm-hmm. If I'm a parent and I take my child to a Lizzo show, I should have zero expectation that that show is not going to become sexually explicit. So I put a tremendous amount of that on the parents. I don't care how they're advertising it. Now, I'm not dismissing the fact that the law was violated here, but I would also suggest that any parent taking their kid, their 12-year-old, to a Lizzo show that doesn't know what they're getting into, probably on the parent, because I don't know a lot about Lizzo, but I've seen her on Saturday Night Live before, and I know the type of shows she does. So I would fully expect that there would just be that and a lot more. So I agree with you that, you know, the law needs to be equitably applied to all comers, no matter how many famous people come into town. But there's a lot on the parents when they take their kids to these types of performances.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see if the attorney general or anyone pursues that. The left has also been saying that criminals drive across borders from their utopian blue states to buy guns in gun nut country red states like ours, and the red state lacks laws are to blame. Do you believe that?
No.
I don't either.
I don't believe that criminals have any regard for the law. By definition, law-breaking individuals are going to break the law no matter what the laws say. And so I think it's a complete misdirection to suggest that it's the fault of the red states that the blue states have not solved their crime problem by eliminating guns from the streets. I just don't buy the argument. If you were to make, I mean, well, here's a, I mean, the good example is Covenant School. Covenant School, last I checked, was a gun-free zone. So if laws making it impermissible to bring guns into a gun-free zone worked, then the Covenant School would have never happened in the way that it did 4 weeks ago. So lawbreakers are going to break the laws. The suggestion extends to all the states. So if the blue state people are to tell us that if we would just comply with what they have already done, everything would be fine. And I mean, does anybody believe that we would have a decrease in gun crimes in Chicago, Illinois, if Tennessee passed gun control measures? I mean, I just...
Only the politicians who have something to gain from it.
Right. So, no, I don't buy that premise.
Okay, good. So the Justins, Anna Johnson, the Tennessee Three, I call them Three J's, Justin Pearson from Memphis, Justin Jones, Brother Jones from Nashville, and Gloria Johnson from Knoxville have made national household names for themselves on that issue, while painting leadership in Tennessee and citizens as racist hillbillies. It bothers me because they never mention the Nashville Six, which are the victims of the manslaughter and likely a hate crime. Not that makes, you know, death any deader, but the VP Harris flew in and met with the assembly people, but not the families or the victims. We were only 9 years old, for God's sakes. Or the two Memphis cops that stopped her from killing more people. What do you make of those three politicizing the tragedy?
You know, it angers me, Steve. And I try not to get too worked up about it because I try not to expend too much energy in people that don't matter. I'm saddened at the way that leadership in the Tennessee General Assembly handled the situation, only in as much as the outcome was so positive for these three individuals that are taking advantage of tragedy for their own personal fame, and there's no repercussions to some of their actions. I would note that Gloria Johnson co-signed on one piece of gun control legislation months after it was introduced in the General Assembly. Other than that, Justin Jones and Justin Pearson have co-signed or sponsored on no gun control legislation up until the point that the Covenant School tragedy happened. So if they were that invested in changing the hearts and minds of the state of Tennessee through their representatives in the General Assembly, they had a weird way of showing it because they did not present any legislation. There was no presentation of any legislation on the floor when they took it over with the bullhorn.
And no bill to sign, no bill to even push.
No, I mean, literally, if the speaker had given them the floor and said, okay, we're gonna stop what we're talking about and we're going to focus on what you want us to do, tell us what you want to do. They had nothing to say. They had no bill in front of them. So they're clearly taking advantage of a situation for their own fame. And it's sickening. And I robustly said on the show that I was disturbed by the lack of leadership, not amongst those in the body, although I could be critical of the manner in which they happened at Cameron Sexton and others. But I'm talking about Governor Lee. I'm talking about Senator Hagerty. I'm talking about Senator Blackburn, all of our congresspeople. While the state of Tennessee and the people of the state of Tennessee were being drugged through the mud, called racist gun grabbers who don't care about the lives of children as much as they care about their AR-15s, which was what the national narrative became once the Bullhorn Trio took it over. And I'm thinking, well, where are our leaders to push back on this, clamoring to get on television, on radio, any network that will have them, and demanding some sort of equal time to say no? That the state of Tennessee mourns our children. We're going to do everything we can to invest more in mental health. We're going to do everything we can to hear all voices. But this suggestion that what these three people were doing was protecting democracy, they were attempting to subvert democracy by putting it on. I mean, literally, they tried to stop the democratic process so that they could take over the body and encouraged other people to do so.
They never use the word democracy, right? Anyway, they're just using Bernie Sanders does, but yeah.
Right, right. You kind of give up on the premise that, you know, we're a representative republic. But I mean, if not for the good sense of the people in the rotunda and the people in the gallery, I don't know what would have happened that day, because they were being encouraged to bum rush the floor.
Yeah.
And
well, we've seen that in Madison, Wisconsin, where they did millions of dollars damage. Right. We saw that in the Capitol January 6th, where obviously windows were broken. I mean, who knows? Like you say, they were protecting the institution while these two were doing who knows what in an era when bad things have happened. Okay, you were 19 years in Birmingham, Alabama. I've been there, the birthplace of civil rights movement, great civil rights museum near Martin Luther King's childhood home, saw all that. A violent place, though. There was a shooting in the park while I was there on Mother's Day, no less. On the total crime index, 100 is safest, and it gets a 1. Literally only safer than 1% of U.S. Now, 20.57 crimes per 1,000 versus Alabama at 6. Memphis is worse, though. It gets a 0. Nobody's worse than them. 25 per 1,000 and 6.75 for all of Tennessee. Do you pay attention to what's happening in Memphis on your show? And I just want to throw out that Nashville is only 11.87 per 1,000 and Knoxville merely 8. Those are the three districts that these three represent. New York City is only 5. Chicago's 8.7, San Francisco 5. So it looks like Justin Pearson and Memphis need to enforce their gun laws and instead of forcing them on the rest of us in Tennessee.
Well, right. I mean, and I, you know what, if there's any credit to be given to the Pearsons of the world, it's the idea that we are paying a little more attention to his backyard. And we are noticing that he isn't paying that much attention to his backyard. Here's what I would encourage the Justins to do, because you're right. If you take the crime stats out of Davidson County, Shelby County, and out of Knox County, eliminate them from the state of Tennessee. I mean, the state of Tennessee looks a lot better in terms of criminal activity if you take those metropolitan areas out. Now, obviously, the metro areas are going to have more crime. I get that. I'm not ignorant of that fact. However, I would encourage these three to focus in on their backyards and demonstrate to us how much gun control works by doing. Look, they have the fame now in front of them where they could raise an amount of money to do gun back buyback programs. I want Justin Jones in District 52 in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, to buy every gun in his community from the people that have them and show us how truly the crime is a result of the guns that are within the community and see what happens.
And I'm curious if Gabriel or if Gloria had been voted on third instead of second, and Pearson had been voted out and not had a vote to save her by the one vote that she was saved, and I do blame Republicans for not doing that, I don't think Knoxville would have sent her back like the other two did, because Knoxville is not Nashville or Memphis when it comes to this. I just showed the crime statistics. She's using them in a way that I don't know if she could even win re-election. I'm going to run out of time with you. I wasn't sure if I wanted to even go here on this, but can I play a clip real quick and then ask you some questions about it?
Absolutely.
Okay, you probably know this is coming. Go for it.
Okay, hold on.
While you drag people through the mud with what you claim to know.
Time will tell, but I am telling you, I am sure of my information.
Mute there, Stever.
You are sure of your information. You stand by your story.
I just stand by my story.
Outside the fact that I just factually demonstrated that parts of your story are inaccurate.
Were you there?
No, but I talked to people who were, ma'am.
Great, and I did too.
We'll let the audience decide. I don't know
in
how
the
you.
Video,
I don't,
in the video, doesn't quite match with many things.
Within 30 minutes, you were told this story before the identity of the shooter came out. And I want to know how that happened.
From a phone call.
Someone told you who the shooter was before the authorities
They never told me a name. They thought it was a teenager.
Well, then how did you know that there was this so-called relationship?
Shortly thereafter.
How did you know 30 minutes after this happened that this was a lover's quarrel, which is what you said 2 days ago?
Yep, that's what I was told.
It's what you were told.
Yes.
I know you're a church-going woman. I hope you get down on your knees and pray about this.
Well, great. And you too. I hope you go to church too.
Good for you. Thank you, Gabrielle.
Awesome. Thank you.
I hope that you're forced to resign your position as alderman in Franklin, Tennessee. It is a gross display of lies and innuendo. What?
Okay. So, have to go there tonight. Actually, in 9 minutes, the Franklin City Council begins their session, and at 7 p.m., they are voting to expel her. I caught your show yesterday, and you said you didn't bump into Gabrielle in Franklin last weekend. One of the reasons that probably didn't happen is, I don't know if you know this, but she was out of state because people came to her house, and some people harassed her daughter at her work following her time on your show. And so I'm just wondering if you knew all that and if any thoughts on being a little rough on her, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, here's what I said in the aftermath of that interview, Steve, because I had a number of people call and express frustration with me because they felt like I was rude. And I said to each and every one of them, yes, I was rude. I was rude and inconsiderate to Gabrielle Hansen, a person that I don't know personally. The reason that I was rude is because I believed her to be a liar. I still believe that she's lying. I do not believe her story. I don't believe the facts back up her story. I don't know why She is motivated to lie in the way that she did. But you know what? If she's telling these stories in her own home, to her circle of friends, or in her own sphere of influence, that's one thing. When she comes on, I'm not buttering you up when I say this, but when she comes on a very popular local podcast as an alderman and makes those statements, one would think that she has the brain power to understand that that's going to get out into the community. I do not support in any way any threats against anyone. I do not support in any way people coming to people's houses to picket or to threaten. I'm against it, and I stand against it, even if I vehemently disagree with someone's position on an issue or feel like they're lying to the general public. So I'm against any move to threaten or to cause physical harm to anyone, particularly Gabrielle Hansen, and I want to make that clear. At the same time, I'm saddened that she chose to take a position and to stake her reputation, and by extension, to put the reputation of Franklin on the line by staking out a position that is factually untrue. So I wish the woman the best from a personal perspective, but I stand by the fact that I think the people of Franklin deserve better.
Well, let me ask you this. So she said in that clip, I didn't play all of it because it was a little bit long, you know, don't quote me as I have no facts or proof, but she stands by her source to this minute. Why would you be so certain she's lying and want her to resign when it's actually maybe a source that may or may not someday come forward and vindicate her? Or here's the key, they're not releasing the manifesto. Here's the quote from Byron York: Nashville mass killer Audrey Hale left behind cell phones and laptops, as well as a suicide note, 3 folders, and 19 journals. Instead of hinting that the motive, quote, remains unclear, why don't police just release the evidence? That was on NBC News. Metro Nashville council member Courtney Johnson confirmed that the Post, the FBI has already ruled the manifesto would not be released anytime soon. Quote, what I was told is her manifesto was a blueprint on total destruction, and it was so detailed at the level of what she had planned, she said when reached by phone, that document is the wrong person's hands would be astronomically dangerous, she added. So I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe Gabrielle Hansen will be vindicated one day, but I don't know if she's lying. She was on my show when she said it. I wonder who her source is more than I do. Is she lying?
Yeah. And I asked her about the source of this information, and she refused to tell me. I asked her when she refused to say, she said, I'm not going to divulge my source. That's fine. I mean, she can decide whether or not to do that. I asked her who called who. Okay, so you had a telephone conversation some 30 minutes after the shooting happened. Did you call someone or did someone call you? And she told me that she couldn't remember. There were a lot of rumors that came out very, very soon after the Covenant School shooting. One of them, and just to give you an example of one of the reasons that I don't believe she's telling the truth, one of the rumors was that Pastor Scruggs was administering some sort of counseling to the shooter in the case. She repeated that on my show, and the individual that initially said that immediately recanted it like a day later and said, I was mistaken. I thought she was someone else. That's not someone that Pastor Scruggs was counseling. Well, if you listen to the full interview that I did with Gabrielle, I mean, she stated that that was one of the purposes behind the shooter being there, that she wanted to target the pastor's child. And I know from an individual who went to the scene before the bodies were moved that there was virtually no way that the shooter could have targeted an individual child in that dynamic, because she was shooting up a stairwell as the door was opening and the children were coming down the stairwell because the fire alarm went off when she initially set it off by killing Mike Hill, who Gabrielle in the same interview said was accidentally shot in some sort of crossfire scenario, when in fact Hill was the first person that was killed when she entered the building after she'd shot out the glass. So you combine the factual inaccuracies in her statement. She also said that Catherine Kuntz and Cynthia Peake were together when they were shot. That's not true. Cynthia Peake was with the 3 children. The belief is that she was coming down the hall to try to assist the teachers in getting the kids out because they thought it was a fire drill. They had not heard the shots from the lower floors. So you piece all the factual inaccuracies together. And then my basic common sense how unbelievable it is that someone in Franklin, Tennessee, would have gotten a telephone call 30 minutes after events that occurred and said that she got the complete story in the context of that telephone call. It's unbelievable on its face. It's factually inaccurate as she describes it. So is it possible that there were some accuracies in her statement? Sure. And if her statement comes, if her chain of events comes back to be true, I'll be happy to apologize to Gabrielle, but I don't think I'm going to be happy to do that anytime soon.
Yeah. And since it wasn't today in terms of vindication or release or person coming forward, she may be out of it.
Can I just say on the front of the matter, the police absolutely should be releasing this information.
Yeah.
And it is an affront to the good of the public that I understand having to retract certain pieces of information, but a lot of this would be laid to bed if they would release the information, retract or redact what you need to do to protect individuals in this situation. But if they were to release this, I mean, I've said for a long time, Steve, that a lack of information leads to a void, and that void is filled by speculation. And sadly, I don't know Gabrielle, so I don't know her motivations, and I don't want to try to get inside of her head. But I will say that she, on some level, fell prey to the gossip or the speculation involved in that void being present. And because of that, she said what she said. If the police would release this information, we wouldn't have to fill that void, and we wouldn't be where we are.
That's true. And, you know, there's a lot of retaliation for her as well because of the vote for the Pride Festival in Franklin. And so she was able to go from the lone voice to two voices to four votes, tied, put it in the mayor's lap. The mayor voted in favor of it. It's not what Franklin wants, because I was there at the open mic session 3 weeks ago before they voted on it. So she has, let's just say, made some enemies as well. So it's not just what you talked about, but it's something that's in the culture in Franklin right now. And it's,
and trust me, it's an odd place for me to be, to have bleeding heart liberals, is how I would describe them, emailing me, congratulating me on the interview that I did with Gabrielle Hansen. My purpose was not to get after anybody because they're conservative. My purpose was, I went after Gabrielle because I felt like that she was saying things that were not true. And I feel like I have a responsibility, not directly for the people that died in that event, but indirectly, I feel compelled to speak for them if someone is saying things that I fundamentally believe are untrue. And that's what I believed. So, once again, I'm, you know, as the great Charles Barkley was once quoted as saying, I could be wrong in this, Steve, but I doubt it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on with us. I wish I had more time. Hopefully I can have you on again sometime. Tell everyone where they can go to find more about you, maybe your socials, your outside of the radio stuff, and then your call signs again, so people can hear you.
Yeah, I'm on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. It's a radio station located out of Nashville, Tennessee. It's broadcasting all throughout Middle Tennessee. You can find us on all of the social medias. You can find me at Matt Murphy Show. That's my Twitter handle. That's also my Instagram, and Matt Murphy on Facebook. And if you want to email me, matt@murphyshow.com, I'm available for all comers, and I'm happy to talk to anybody that wants to talk to me, either on the radio or privately.
Great. You're a great guest. Thanks again, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Steve Gill, joining you on Mill Creek View. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand how I bring you down to your knees.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard, and we heard a lot. Producer Steve, what do you think of our guest, Matt Murphy, of The Matt Murphy Show?
Well, it's very interesting, Steve. Matt Murphy is the one that spilled the beans of our show after we had already pulled the show from our on-air, our Rumble, and our podcast, and then he did it, and I was like, oh, man, this is going to be a contentious show. But, Steve, how did it line up that you had our former guest last week and that you brought Matt Murphy on? It looks like you just plan this thing out. Would you kind of explain to folks that this was not something that just...
Yeah, I've been getting calls about exactly that. So interestingly enough, last Wednesday, I was supposed to have Speaker of the House Cameron Sexton come on the show, and he declined to come. He canceled for whatever reason. They were going into budget meetings, whatever, doing his day job. And I understand that. It happens sometimes. That was the first time it happened to this show after 81 episodes, but it happened. And Gabrielle stepped in and said, I'll do it. And so I brought her on and we had a great show. We talked about something that was very topical. There was a vote on the gay pride here in Franklin, Tennessee. And so it was a lot of conversation about how the ins and outs of that whole thing went down. And she dropped a bomb, as you know.
Yep.
Well, I had asked Matt to be on the show 30 days ago, May 1st, as a matter of fact. And it finally worked out that he was scheduled to be on today, Tuesday, the 25th of April. So the fact that she was on, went on his show the next day, he uses a clip from my show, which is nice. He's listening to my show and then plays that, causes all kinds of kerfuffle here in town. And I take it down for the death threats and the harassment of her daughter, as if she asked me to. And I said, that's the right thing. I don't want my platform to be used as something that's going to hurt anybody. That's not what this thing's about. We're about lovers of truth. But he did what he did, and now he is. And he was filling in for Brian Wilson, who has a huge platform. Yes. So obviously it was heard all over the place. So it was a big deal. And now the Tennessean wants to talk to me, and I'm probably not going to talk to him, but we'll see how that goes. So anyway, moving on. It's not about me. This is the Mill Creek View. And so now we've heard Matt's view and we've heard Gabrielle's view. And we'll see what the source says someday, or we will, never will. Who
Steve,
knows?
We're still waiting for the law's view. We're waiting for the facts to come out, and they're not.
Yeah, we're still waiting for the Zapruder film to be unedited, right? So, okay. House of Fauci, how Dr. Christine Grady, aka Mrs. Fauci, used her NIH position to backstop her husband's pandemic health directives. America's top doctor and his wife, the chief ethicist, were the administrative state's pandemic dream team. It's the Washington, D.C. power couple that cost taxpayers nearly $1 million per year. While Dr. Anthony Fauci gave the nation its pandemic public policy prescription, his wife, Dr. Christine Grady, the chief bioethicist at Fauci's employer, the National Institute of Health, provided the moral framework. The Faucis are important to the center-left because they represent the pinnacle moment of the administrative state top-down public policy run by an elite group of government scientists. While Tony Fauci was the top-paid federal bureaucrat and out-earned the U.S. president at $480,654 per year, Christine Grady, as the chief bioethicist at NIH, out-earned the U.S. vice president, $234,749, when adding 35% in benefits, the couple cost taxpayers an estimated nearly $1 million per year. Household net worth, which increased from $7.6 million to $12.6 million between the start of 2020 and the end of 2021. So the Faucis lived a conflict of interest at the breakfast table, the office, and back home around the dinner table. However, NIH has never acknowledged this. Oopsies, more bad news for mask lovers. Another study critical of the mouth bandages ran about 2 weeks ago in the journal Public Health, titled Physiometabolic and Clinical Consequences of Wearing Face Masks, Systemic Review with Meta-Analysis and Comprehensive Evaluation. Wow, sounds 360 all-inclusive. Rather than measuring how ineffective masks were at filtering viruses or preventing COVID transmission, these researchers measured various health indicators on the people who wore the mask. What they found was not good. Mask wearers had decreased blood oxygen, increased blood CO2, increased heart rates, high blood pressure, more difficult breathing, high skin temperatures, and higher reports of headaches, acne, skin irritation, feeling overheated, voice disorders, and dizziness. Gosh, who knew? Worse still, the researchers found that even short-term mask wearing can cause long-term medical problems, coining the term mask-induced exhaustion syndrome, MIES. They even attributed that some long COVID cases are really long mask cases.
Yep.
Though evaluated where, though evaluated wearing durations are shorter than daily slash prolonged use, outcomes independently validated mask-induced exhaustion syndrome, MIES, and downstream physiometabolic dysfunctions, MIES, can have long-term clinical consequences, especially for vulnerable groups. So far, several mask-related symptoms may have been misinterpreted as long COVID-19 symptoms. In any case, the possible MIEAs contrasts with the WHO definition of health. If they are right, and even some long COVID is really MIES, chalk up another massive fail by the public health establishment and add to the bill a lot of injured people who would otherwise have been just fine. The researchers' ultimate conclusion was stark. In the absence of strong empirical evidence of effectiveness, mask wearing should not be mandated, let alone enforced by law. This helps explain why some people are still wearing the silly face rags. Their brains are broken. What do you think, Steve? Do you still see them driving around in the car by themselves with masks on?
I've got two people in this office complex that I work that are still wearing them. The one guy can barely walk down the hall. The other guy is just, hi. You know, he's just like oblivious, and I think his brain is literally fried. He's fried.
I can't stand when I see senior citizens wearing them or little kids, because obviously the parents are doing it. And then sometimes the parents aren't even wearing them. It's unbelievable. Okay, we're going to run out of time here, but let's play clip number one.
Responding to it with work, with urgency, with focus on actually addressing the issue, we say, oh, we'll just ban it. We'll just ban it, and that'll be the end of it. Instead of actually thinking about what is going to address this issue in a very real way. In this case, I think one of the things that really infuriates me is that we have a company, Toyota, who makes the Prius, that essentially has a device on their cars, which is super easy to remove. It's basically the value of a MacBook, right? That is put in a place that is incredibly easy to access in your car. And then the thefts related to this issue have essentially all of the costs of that are given to us to bear instead of them having to manufacture a car that actually is not so easy to be stolen. I think it's outrageous. Our police department is dealing with it.
What is that all about, Steve?
That's a crazy councilwoman in Los Angeles talking about Prius and Toyota being to blame for catalytic converter theft because of the placement of the valuable piece of machinery, as opposed to worrying more about the criminal than the target of crime, right? Okay, moving on. Urgent. Moderna hit serious side effects suffered by its COVID vaccine recipients when it reported clinical trials resulted for the shot. See, this is another reason why we're not on YouTube. I could not say any of these words and still be telling you, dear listener, what I want to say. Moderna scientists said in a 2021 paper, no mRNA jab recipients in the trial had, quote, serious adverse effects. In fact, 14 ultimately did, including three miscarriages. No placebo recipients did. In February 2021, Moderna scientists published results from the phase two trial of the company's mRNA COVID jab in the journal Vaccine. Moderna had started the P201 trial with 600 healthy volunteers on May 29, 2020, mostly to examine if the shots were safe. The company had good news on that front. In the highlight section at the top of the paper, Moderna scientists reported no serious adverse effects were observed. That statement was untrue. Did the FDA just admit that it overdosed people with COVID vaccines? The dosage in the new bivalent vaccine has been cut by 75%. Emerald Robinson, April 21st. 2 days ago, the Food and Drug Administration made some monumental changes in the COVID vaccine schedule in the proverbial dead of night that should concern everyone. The FDA essentially revoked the authorization for all previously licensed COVID vaccines. It's the end of the old monovalent doses. The FDA also cut the dosage for all the new bivalent vaccines by 75%. Now ban mRNA from planet Earth, okay? The Babylon Bee satire website is suing Big Bad California. The state of California passed a law in 2022 that imposes new regulations on social media companies. This law, AB 587, requires companies to give the California Attorney General's Office regular reports regarding disinformation, misinformation, extremism, radicalization, and hate speech. The law allows the state to impose fines if companies do not comply with these reporting regulations. You may be asking, isn't controlling misinformation and hate speech online a good thing? The truth of the matter is that the government and big tech companies working together to control what everyone is allowed to say is a bad thing. A good thing is when everyone is allowed to speak freely. Not everyone's definition of misinformation or hate speech are the same. In the case of our work at Babylon Bee, jokes and satire are often incorrectly cited as examples of misinformation or hateful conduct by organizations and government agencies who think our views don't fit their prescribed narrative. When people in power don't like what you have to say, they can use that power to categorize your speech as hateful, even if what you're saying is factually accurate. Seth Dillon, CEO, Babylon Bee. Clip number two, please.
Why don't we just pair up?
I'm not into touching, okay? I'm not letting you put that out front. I'm no touching, no touching.
No touching, I won't touch you.
I was paired up with Isaac. He was like, no touching. I was like, oh, this is going to be fun.
The music will start, the boys will turn around. So, right. Gentlemen, let's turn. Gorgeous. And then we start walking.
Yeah.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Three, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. And then maybe let's look at the gentleman. Gentlemen, you guys can acknowledge us. Ooh, who is this?
Cool. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't do this. I can't do this. I'm sorry. I'm a man of God. I can't do this.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I love those people. I pray for them. I would never do anything to hurt them or condemn them. But men are not supposed to dress like women. I'm not going to go along with that. It's time to stand up and be a man of God.
All right, I'm calling that clip Grandpa Won't Dance. What did you just see there, Steve, since it's not a video show?
Basically, it's a bunch of transvestites with these old men. But my question is, I think the guy knew that this was the show that had that. Why did he even go on there? So I'm going to be the little squeaky.
The cynic. Oh, you cynic.
I know.
Okay.
Yes. Why is he on there?
I don't know, but it was funny anyway. All right. This just in, breaking in Beer Business Daily. Management changes. Todd Allen appointed VP Bud Light, former Bud Light marketing VP Alyssa Heinerscheid. Remember her?
Yes.
Who was at the post for not quite a year, is off the brand. We understand she has decided to take a leave of absence. Quote, today we communicated some next steps with our internal teams and wholesaler partners, per AB spokesperson Ambev. First, we made it clear that the safety and welfare of our employees and our partners is our top priority. Second, Todd Allen is appointed vice president of Bud Light, reporting directly to Benoit Garbe, U.S. Chief Marketing Officer. Third, we have made some adjustments to streamline the structure of our marketing function to reduce layers so that our most senior marketers are more closely connected to every aspect of our brand's activities. These steps will help us maintain focus on the things we do best, brewing great beer for all consumers while always making a positive impact in our communities and our country. I'm just glad to know there is a Beer Business Daily. I didn't know that. Wow. Well, go woke, go broke is what I always say. All right, last one. Clip three, please.
House floor Thursday following the first full day back of the two reinstated lawmakers.
That you don't even know what the purpose of this bill is besides to feed into this racist narrative that you've been promoting all session. And so my question to you,
Representative Jones, that's a personal attack and you're out of order. Please refrain from making those claims when you're on the bill. Thank you.
The debate was over. House Bill 1367, which would limit what can be taught on Tennessee college campuses. Action News 5's Kelly Cook live now in studio with a look at the Tennessee Higher Education Freedom from Expression Act. Kelly.
Well, Joy, professors and students on Tennessee college and university campuses could face penalties for discussing topics that the bill calls divisive. Well, just minutes after being sworn back into office Thursday, Representative Justin J. Pearson was once again at odds with the Republican Party. House Bill 1376, also called the Tennessee Higher Education Freedom from Expression Act, was up for its final reading on the House floor Thursday. Now, this bill lists divisive topics not to be discussed, like one race or sex is inherently superior or inferior to another race or sex, or an individual by virtue of the individual's race or sex is inherently privileged, racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously.
The impact is to keep colleges about advancing knowledge and not advancing personal political or social agendas.
This sounds like fascism. This sounds like authoritarianism. This does not sound like democracy or freedom. And so again, this bill is very troubling.
Now, Representative Pearson says the new bill would eliminate discussion of items such as white privilege or unconscious biases. Representative Reagan says his bill creates a transparent system for identifying and tracking these alleged violations. The bill is now en route to the governor for his signature.
Yeah. Well, who cares what a college professor overpaid dummy says anyway? There were those buzzwords again, fascism and always using the word democracy wrong. Pearson, we're now again talking about what they say is the Tennessee Three. Pearson says the new bill would eliminate discussion of items such as white privilege or unconscious bias. That's good, right? The bill would create a transparent system to allow students or faculty to report any violations and require education institutions to maintain a list of violators. Yikes. I don't think I will have that much of an impact, said Tennessee State University Professor LaRotha Williams Jr. If the state comes at me or my beloved university comes at me and I would have to do it this way versus that way, then they are infringing on academic freedom. Williams says many of the topics on the banned list are fair game in his class. I leave it to the students to conclude whatever conclusions they want to draw, said Williams. Despite the debate, the bill passed overwhelmingly 68-26. Reagan says the idea, when we've had him on the show, Reagan says the idea of the bill was brought to him by a dean of a college of education at another university, but he wouldn't reveal publicly who it was. See, you don't give up your sources. The bill is headed to Governor Bilsley's desk for his signature. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to my quotes for the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the Mill Creek View podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and hit the subscribe button and follow us. While you're there, go ahead and leave a comment. And thanks for doing it. Every day, we are slathered with the biggest bunk of lies and distortions and half-truths that I can recall. And all the while, the American left is doing its best to bring down this country as founded. Rush Limbaugh. I've always been about honesty, whether on the radio, whether I did a movie, whether I wrote a book, as long as you're honest, you don't lose your edge. Howard Stern. One of my producers said this business is like a hamster on that little wheel thing that goes around and around. You may have a great day and get great ratings, but then you've got another show to do. Whatever moment of success or happiness you have, you've got to keep grinding it out for the next day. Sean Hannity. The second you think that all your good fortune is a product of your virtue, you become highly judgmental, lacking empathy, totally without self-awareness, arrogant, stupid, I mean all the stuff that our ruling class is. Tucker Carlson. I'll miss you. When the politicians complain that TV turns the proceedings into a circus, it should be made clear that the circus is already there and that TV has merely demonstrated that not all the performers are well-trained. Edward R. Murrow. He was an American broadcast journalist and war correspondent. He first gained prominence during World War II with a series of live radio broadcasts from Europe for the news division of CBS, a pioneer of radio and television news broadcasting. Without Edward R. Murrow, none of those three, and not the Mill Creek View podcast. That's it for this episode. Really hope you liked it. Thank you, Matt Murphy. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Peace in our time.
County Fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder. Thank you.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.